Welcome back to Lungcast, the monthly respiratory health podcast series from the American Lung Association and medical news site hcplive.com. I'm your host, Dr. Albert Rizzo, Chief Medical Officer of the ALA. Before we introduce our topic and our guest today, just a reminder that Lungcast is available on all your favorite streaming platforms. Subscribe to @Lungcast on YouTube to get new and archived episodes, as well as interview segments and episode highlights as they come out. A link to the show page, as well as the American Lung Association and HCP Live homepages for Lungcast, can be found in each episode description. For those of you who prefer a podcast, you can subscribe to Lungcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and your favorite listening platforms. You can also register for more respiratory news and insights at both lung.org and hcplive.com. The development of biomarkers to assess for or screen for underlying cancer at early stages of disease has made significant advances over the last several decades. These biomarkers utilize simple blood draws, urine, saliva, or stool specimens. They usually fall into two main categories: multi-cancer early detection tests, or what's called MCEDs, and organ-specific early detection tests. There are only select cancers, breast, cervical, colorectal, and lung, that have USPSTF recommended screening guidelines to date. Data supports the fact that the use of single cancer screening tests has reduced cancer-related mortality for these malignancies. However, data also shows that 70% of the deaths due to cancer in the United States among those aged 50 to 79 years of age are caused by cancers without USPSTF recommended screening, and partly as a result, U.S. cancer mortality exceeds 600,000 cases per year. Now, this has led to the development of multi-cancer early detection tests, or MCEDs, as I mentioned, which are usually blood-based tests that can screen for multiple types of cancer in a single sample. Lung cancer is often one of the results sought with these MCEDs. There are pros and cons to the use of the MCEDs versus organ-specific biomarker screens, and these can range from accuracy depending on the cancer stage, the determination of who and when to screen with the test, and also the important issues around downstream consequences for patients, including further testing, but also the cost of the biomarker test itself and the uncertain coverage by third-party payers. To give us a more comprehensive perspective on this landscape of different biomarker approaches, we are joined today by Dr. Lindsay Cotton, who is a clinician scientist and healthcare leader of over 20 years, whose medical and scientific research has focused specifically on the emerging field of early cancer detection through liquid biopsy biomarkers, especially over the last 6 years. She has held leadership roles in biomarker companies, including Grail, Guardant Health, and Delphi Diagnostics. These companies have tests either available or in development in this biomarker space. Today's Lungcast discussion does not endorse or recommend any specific testing or company. I'm asking Dr. Cotton to explain the current science and understanding of these types of tests in a non-competitive space. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you, Dr. Rizzo. It's a pleasure to be here today. I'm humbled and excited for our discussion.
Thank you. So before we begin discussing the different aspects of the MCEDs versus the organ-specific tests, please level set for our listeners what some of the specific types of substances are being assayed in the blood by the different tests that are being used out there.
Yeah, I think that's a good place to start. So there's a lot of different approaches in this biomarker landscape. It can be pretty diverse too. So there's different signals that different companies look to target. So for blood-based biomarkers specifically, they're going to be looking for molecular signals of cancer that are released in the circulation. And I'll break it down into a few different categories for what different companies are measuring. But for your listeners who might not be as familiar with like blood-based biomarkers and what we'd be looking at. So in our bodies, cells naturally die and get replaced all the time. In fact, we replace billions of cells daily through a process called apoptosis, which is like our cells program cell death, completely normal and natural. Think of it like our body's way of constantly renovating a house, taking down old structures, building new ones. But when these cells die and they release fragments or pieces of their contents into our bloodstream, that's what's most commonly analyzed. And so we can look at it a few different ways. cfDNA or cell-free DNA, those are the fragments of the DNA that circulate in the bloodstream after being released from the cells. Most cfDNA comes from a normal cell, but a small fraction of that may originate from a tumor cell where cancer is present in the body. Some of them look at ctDNA, so circulating tumor DNA. So that's a subset of cfDNA, but that specifically comes from a tumor cell. Some companies look and analyze ctDNA for specific cancer mutations that are the genetic alterations that are present in or not present in a normal cell. There are some companies looking at DNA methylation patterns. So this actually looks beyond the mutation. They're looking at epigenetic modifications for DNA. So methylation is a chemical change that affects gene expression without altering your DNA itself. Some companies look at fragmentomics. It's a little bit of a newer approach that looks at how DNA breaks apart. So interestingly, tumor-derived DNA tends to fragment in these distinct patterns compared to normal cells. And so by analyzing the fragment sizes and breakpoints, tests could identify cancer signals even without looking at the genetic sequence itself. And then the second major category involves this molecular phenotyping. So looking at revealed in proteins or proteomics, metabolites, RNA. And so with proteins, cancer can alter the type and amount of protein in our circulation. Proteins are particularly valuable biomarkers because they're a functional unit of our cells, and it directly reflects cellular activities and communication. RNA signatures are also looked at in the bloodstream, looking at microRNAs. They can indicate cancer. And also metabolites. So cancer often have, cancer cells have an altered metabolism, change the type and the amount of metabolic byproducts in the bloodstream. So there's a lot of different things companies can be looking at. I think what's particularly exciting is the emergence of these multi-omic or multimodal approaches, where rather than looking at just one marker, these integrated tests simultaneously analyze multiple biomarker types, perhaps looking at DNA with proteins or proteins with RNA and fragmentomics. And then they take it with machine learning algorithms. They integrate all these different signals, and that helps improve the detection accuracy with the aim of enabling detection, earlier detection, when it's most treatable. And this field has been evolving rapidly. You and I have known each other for several years, and just in that time span alone, so much advancement has happened, and we continue to better understand cancer biology and how more sensitive technologies can become. And I'm often asked then, well, what's the best marker? Like, which is the best one? What's the best approach? I think it depends. It depends on so many different things. But think of it like this. Imagine you're a detective trying to determine a crime, if there's a crime in a house. If you only look at fingerprints in the house, you might miss where a crime where the perpetrator wore gloves. If you only look for forced entry, you might be missing where someone actually had a key to get in. But if you examine the fingerprints and the footprints, or you look at DNA evidence, or maybe pull security camera footage, you'll get a more complete picture, and you're far less likely to miss the important clues of what's happening. And cancer detection is really similar. So each cancer is going to leave behind different clues in the bloodstream. Some might shed more DNA. Some might release specific proteins. Others might have a distinct RNA pattern. And so when we look at these multiple types of evidence simultaneously, we're much more likely to detect or understand the cancer's presence, even if it's trying to hide itself in one way or another. So I think the answer is, well, a comprehensive approach is probably going to be the best one for early detection when those signals are subtle and easily missed if you're only looking at one clue, in case this one, a biomarker. So looking at multiple are probably going to be the best bet.
Very good background, and I like your analogy about the detective and the crime scene.
Yeah, it helps, right?
That's right. So with all these diagnostic tests, I know we strive for the best sensitivity and specificity when we're looking at results. Please explain again for our listeners what these terms are, and tell us how the potential consequences of things such as false positive or false negative tests may impact the ability of a test to be helpful and also impact the patient who's being tested.
Yeah, that's such a good question, and probably more complex to answer than expected, because while the definitions themselves are very straightforward, it's the clinical context on how they're applied that varies depending on what you're looking at. And so, as we know, you know, sensitivity and specificity are fundamental concepts and performance characteristics in screening and diagnostic testing. And as you mentioned in your introduction, there's been significant development in multi-cancer detection tests, and these screen for 50 plus cancer types, including lung cancer. So when we evaluate the tests that are either multi-cancer or organ-specific or single cancer screening that you mentioned, understanding the sensitivity and specificity is really crucial to the implications of the performance characteristics as a clinician or even as a patient, too, of what you would expect. So before I get to that point, I'll start with basic definitions. So sensitivity measures how well a test identifies people who actually have the disease, in this instance, cancer. So tests with 90% sensitivity will correctly identify 90% of cancer cases, but it'll miss 10%. Those are our false negatives. Specificity is essentially how good is a test at avoiding these false alarms. With 95% specificity out of 100 healthy people, 95 will get no cancer result, but 5 will get an incorrect cancer alert. So when you apply that to population screening, though, those numbers start becoming much more significant. If you screen 10,000 healthy people with an 80% specific test, you generate 2,000 false positives or false alarms. If you look at 10,000 people and your test is 50% specific, that's 5,000. And so it really depends on what you're looking at and how you're applying it. And the impact of the performance characteristics, or if you look at it another way, the errors vary dramatically by context, which really speaks to your point about the pros and cons from like MCED versus organ-specific biomarker screens. So for multi-cancer tests, without in the instance of them not having a clear follow-up pathway, for example, false positives can lead patients and their providers to what I call this diagnostic wilderness. They're navigating this unfamiliar territory with no established pathways, potentially undergoing numerous uninsured tests to determine diagnostic resolution, creating exactly those downstream consequences that you mentioned. And the MCED tests typically do yield a high specificity, though. So they're around 99.5. So they're reducing a good portion of those false positive concerns, which is really important. Now, in contrast, when testing is tied to an established screening program like lung cancer screening, even a test with moderately lower specificity could actually provide a lot of value if it's directing all of the high-risk patients towards their low-dose CT scan. So they should be getting that test anyways. The key questions are whether the follow-up pathway is clear, whether it's guideline recommended, and it's covered by insurance. Addressing your important about these important questions about uncertain coverage by payers too, meaning is the reflex test covered for the patient? Are we ensuring that our patient's moving forward towards evidence-based guideline-recommended testing? If the answer is yes, then a lower specificity, maybe like 70, 80%, maybe even lower to 60, could be an acceptable trade-off. But I think it's important to then talk about the false negatives, because that's the biggest concern, right? If we're moving patients to a test they should be getting, that's one thing. But the false negatives occur when a test fails to detect a cancer that's actually present. They're directly tied to a test sensitivity. Lower sensitivity is going to mean false negatives. That is a one-to-one relationship. No one wants to miss an actionable cancer. And I'll use lung cancer as a prime example because false negatives in this demographic can be catastrophic. And I'll explain why. So lung cancer has one of the steepest stage-dependent survival curves of any cancer. I know you know this, but for any of our listeners or your listeners that don't know this, it's the 10-year survival rate for a localized stage one cancer, meaning if we are screening all of our patients and we detect their cancer in its earliest stage, at stage one, and we can perform curative intent treatments, over 73% of those patients are still alive after 10 years from their diagnosis. But if that same cancer isn't detected until it reaches stage four, the chance of them being here with us, their five-year survival rate is for the scientific term, it plummets to less than 6%. And unfortunately, the majority of patients are being diagnosed in stage three and stage four. And so that stark difference makes early detection absolutely crucial in this space. And it literally will transform lung cancer from being a potentially or likely curable disease to almost uniformly a fatal one. And this is where biomarkers face their greatest challenge. It's that they often have their lowest sensitivity in early stage disease, exactly when detection would actually offer the greatest benefit. So if we look at some concrete numbers, I think it's important to understand when we hear numbers in this space as patients, providers, researchers, how to break them down. Often companies will report their overall sensitivity. What they're typically doing is they're averaging their performance across all stages, or we call it an aggregate. So a test might claim that they're 85% sensitivity, or they're 85% sensitive for, let's say, lung cancer, for example, which sounds impressive. That's a good sensitivity number. However, if you parse it out and you look at stage-specific data, you might find that same test might be 95% sensitive for stage four disease, but only 40% for stage one. So you're looking at all your patients of 60% false negative rate in your stage one disease, 60% missing early stage in highly treatable, potentially highly treatable lung cancers, while reliably detecting late stage disease when treatments are far more limited. So the problem is compounded for lung cancer specifically is that majority of these patients are all asymptomatic when they come in. And so they receive, if they receive a false negative result, they're unlikely to pursue additional testing until their symptoms develop, which generally doesn't occur until, as you know, the cancers progress significantly. And by the time symptoms prompt further investigation, that window for curative intent is probably closed. And so that's why I always want to emphasize transparency around stage-specific sensitivity when evaluating these types of tests. The overall number can mask the critical weakness that occurs in early detection. And for something specific like lung cancer, regardless if you're looking at an MCED test that looks at lung cancer within it, or just a lung cancer test on its own, it's understanding that false negative rate or the sensitivity for stage one and stage two disease.
Very good point about the stage specificity when you're looking at how well these tests are going to be done. I wanted to switch gears a little bit because many of these tests, when you read about them, they have a number of designations that are used to describe their status with regard to terms like LDTs, CLIA, CAP, FDA. Please break down what some of these designations mean and the importance with regard to availability and coverage for the physicians and patients out there.
Yeah, Dr. Rizzo, it's like an alphabet soup, right, of diagnostic testing. It can certainly be confusing to navigate all the acronyms. There's actually been a lot happening in this space lately, too. But we'll start with LDT, or laboratory developed tests. These tests are designed, manufactured, and used within a single laboratory or sometimes within large academic and healthcare systems. What many people don't realize, even clinicians themselves, is that majority of the blood tests we order as clinicians, like upwards of 90%, are actually LDTs. We just don't call them that. And so many hospitals and healthcare systems develop and use LDTs, particularly larger hospitals and academic medical centers, all the time. They range from routine tests like blood count tests to complex molecular testing, genetic testing for cancer, heart disease, rare and infectious disease. So it's, we use it all the time. We just don't call it that, except in this space, this is the language we use. LDTs are really critical for providing timely patient access to accurate, high-quality testing for many conditions in which no other commercial test or possibly even an FDA-approved test meets the current clinical needs. And where it gets interesting is you can go both pathways. So back in 1976, the FDA gained authority to regulate medical devices, and there was a recognition they had where they couldn't feasibly oversee every test developed by clinical laboratories. They had so many other things to focus on, approving medications and therapies and all that. So the FDA essentially gave their regulatory oversight to LDTs for the Centers of Medicare and Medicaid Services, CMS. This oversight by CMS takes the form of Clinical Laboratory Improvement Amendments, or CLIA, so C-L-I-A. Any laboratory that performs testing on human specimens must be CLIA certified. And CLIA certification ensures that the lab meets not just basic quality standards, but they have requirements for personnel qualifications. They have rigorous quality control procedures, proficiency testing, record keeping. It's a very rigorous regulatory process. They also pursue CAP accreditation. CAP is the College of American Pathologists. CAP accreditation is considered the gold standard for laboratory quality assurance, with requirements that even exceed those of CLIA. So most labs you'll see are CLIA and CAP accredited. Now, last year in April in 2024, the FDA actually made a final rule that they were going to amend their regulations from 1976, and they were going to take back the authority to review and have oversight of all LDTs. So everyone that existed were going to have this four-year process where they were going to reinforce and they were going to take discretion of taking over the discretion of covering these tests and LDTs, similar to what they do for IVDs, in vitro diagnostics. However, earlier this past month, the United States District Court ruled that the FDA doesn't have authority and they're not going to do that. So that whole phase out deadline has been currently, now it's not in effect. So it keeps going back and forth. It'll be interesting to see how this plays out over the next few years. But I think the question is, if you can function as an LDT, why would a company pursue FDA approval when they could just operate as an LDT? And the main reasons are for guideline inclusion and insurance coverage. So tests with FDA approval are much more likely to be incorporated into clinical practice guidelines and receive coverage from Medicare and private insurers. So once the FDA clears or approves a test, it moves from being considered an LDT to an IVD, an in vitro diagnostic, which opens the door for more broader clinical adoption. And so, you know, there's been a lot of different movement in this space. Some companies do them in parallel. I'll give an example, a successful example. Guardant Health had their Shield test that, you know, the Shield test was their first blood test approved by the FDA as a primary screening option for colorectal cancer, and it met all of those requirements. And so that approval for the Shield biomarker test was a significant victory in the advancement of medicine for just the entire field, for patients, providers, giving them access. So they're not the only one in the space. There's many others, but those advancements of getting FDA approval for biomarkers has shown a big leap forward in the confidence by the FDA in these testing and how they can improve our healthcare overall.
You made sense of a complicated issue. Thank you.
I'll try.
So I want to switch a little bit more over to lung cancer specific testing. Now, you may have touched on some of this already, but I think lung cancer screening and the concept of CT scan is important. We know that low-dose CT scan is being used for lung cancer screening, and the trial of getting these things approved dates back almost three decades. Some early observational studies of high-risk individuals showed that the low-dose CT scan detected more lung cancers than chest x-rays, but many of them detected were early stage. However, it wasn't until the definitive National Lung Screening Trial, which was a randomized trial of over 50,000 high-risk current and former smokers comparing low-dose CT screening to chest x-ray, in 2011, this study showed that a statistically significant 20% lung cancer mortality reduction occurred in the low-dose CT arm. And as a result of that, the USPSTF back in 2013 made a level B recommendation for screening techniques to be encouraged and covered for this procedure by third-party payers. This was through the Affordable Care Act that was passed. Medicare coverage followed shortly thereafter. From the start, the screening coverage has required a specific shared decision-making documentation to be part of the process. And during this discussion, the risks and benefits for the patients are often outlined with regard to courses of action that will be taken based on the results of the test. Patients and at times their healthcare providers sometimes get hesitant to proceed with screening if they're concerned about downstream procedures, complications, and costs, especially if a non-cancerous finding occurs. So again, give us your perspective on this. And do you think that the biomarker test may have a role to be more specific and sensitive and help allay some of the patient and physician's concerns.
Yeah, this is indeed a complicated space. It's been many years to get to where we are today. And unfortunately, we just haven't progressed very far in the last few decades. So the concept of shared decision making, while I believe it was very well intentioned, it does have polarizing positioning depending on who you ask, on the steps that you need to go through and the process, and if that limits or hinders and is a barrier itself to lung cancer screening. So I'm hesitant to draw a definitive conclusion about causation versus correlation here, but there are multiple factors contributing to those low screening rates. And I do think that biomarkers can make an impact. But I think it's important to also call out that there's the participation rates and the slow trajectory. Even if we had a biomarker that was available today that was really effective, it's how we implement it and how we integrate it into the systems that's going to be really important. And I'll take a step back and just say that well over a decade ago, you know, this problem with lung cancer screening and it not being done didn't happen overnight. You've mentioned 30 years of this being done, and we know that so many great trials were done and completed proving the mortality benefit. And I think we've been held back for a lot of different reasons. There was some, you know, we had some consequential voices and academic positioning that enabled kind of this redirection of scientific consensus at points in time that effectively put the brakes on uptake. They reduced that argument of how effective the NLST and Nelson trials were. And I mean, overall, I think we had individuals that were doing, unfortunately, really well at missing the forest for the trees on the benefit of lung cancer screening and took a really myopic approach on the process. And, you know, these weren't just harmless academic debates, but they were looking, you know, they affected the cost, they affected cost of lives and the expense of maintaining this contrarianism despite and challenging scientific consensus. And so the fallout's been, we've been playing catch up ever since. You know, we've battled not just medical misconceptions, but deep-rooted stigma. Lung cancer screening has often been portrayed as something to fear, something to blame patients for rather than a potentially life-saving intervention. And those early campaigns, they didn't help patients. They shamed them. But I think there is an exciting part. You mentioned this, and you know me. I might be very pragmatic, but I'm also, you know, I fill my cup with optimism. So the scientific committee, the scientific community is really now universally recognizing the benefits of screening. We know we can reduce lung cancer mortality by 20-25% with screening. We just got to get them screened. And we know we have an unprecedented opportunity to save more lives through improved screening, probably more than any other cancer program, because we have the largest gap to fill. We have a huge catch up. And so what's holding us back? Well, I mean, it's not just one thing. We're talking about multiple barriers: limited access to screening centers, physician awareness, primary care adoption, complex eligibility criteria, different guideline recommendations, concerns about radiation exposure. The list goes on. But I do think this is where biomarkers can become our game changer. So a blood test that could pre-screen these high-risk individuals who've not had a low-dose CT, a test that could guide patients to imaging, augmenting that shared decision-making process between a patient and a provider to improve uptake. We're talking about removing barriers, reducing unnecessary procedures, and most importantly, it then saves lives. And so it's not just about technology. It's about human lives. It's about giving patients hope, giving doctors better tools, fundamentally changing the way that we approach lung cancer screening. And I've been doing this for many years. And so providers and healthcare systems, they're ready for this type of test. They're wanting more tools. The only missing piece is currently a biomarker that can accurately detect those stage one and stage two cancers with high sensitivity. So I'm excited. 2025, I think there's going to be a lot of good data that's coming out with considerable advancements in this space that's going to make an impact on early detection. And I do think that those biomarkers can help that process with shared decision-making, bringing more people into the scanner.
Well, certainly you've been very well versed in the science and research behind these biomarkers, but you've also been very active in the advocacy space around coverage for tests such as this. Can you kind of tell us where you think things stand in the current political climate?
Yeah, I have been pretty deeply involved in the advocacy and policy work in this area. And you know, it's something I'm very passionate about. The coverage landscape for biomarker testing is a little complex, but it's evolving. There's several encouraging developments, though, worth noting. So, you know, currently multi-cancer detection tests generally aren't covered by Medicare, private insurance, some limited exceptions. Most patients pay out of pocket. Those tests often are approaching about $1,000, which does create an obvious access disparity issue. For lung cancer-specific biomarkers, access is primarily through clinical trials. Some innovative health systems have adopted the technologies, or there's patient self-pay. I think in the current political climate, I have some cautious optimism. The current administration has voiced commitment to cancer prevention initiatives, which aligns well with expanding access to early detection technologies. And so there's a lot of really important legislative efforts on the Hill that are working right now to improve access to innovation. We don't have time to talk about all of them. I'll touch on two of them today. So for the first, there's one that has been out there for a while now. It's a Medicare Multi-Cancer Early Detection Screening Coverage Act that would create a coverage pathway for FDA to approve multi-cancer tests. And while this legislation has been introduced in previous sessions without passing, the growing evidence base and the bipartisan support has really been improving its prospects, I think. And there are some really brilliant and talented advocacy and government affairs teams working diligently on that effort. And so I'm excited to watch that continue over the course of this year. Additionally, there's the Lung Cancer Screening and Prevention Act of 2025 that was reintroduced to the new administration earlier this year. That's sponsored by Representative Vern Buchanan. I really think that could be a transformative for lung cancer biomarkers specifically. So this legislation would allow Medicare to make its own determination for covering a biomarker test without them being mandated to wait for USPSTF to first make their recommendation. So potentially accelerating or unlocking Medicare access to this years before others. Because right now, USPSTF, if the next time they come out with a rating for lung cancer screening, is averaging right now projected about 2029. And so this legislation, if it goes through, could really unlock it a lot earlier. And about USPSTF, you know, they are due right now to redo their lung cancer screening guidelines, which presents another incredible opportunity for this space. Many in the field, as I am too, are really hoping they consider removing that arbitrary 15-year quit date criteria, that recognizing lung cancer screening risk doesn't just drop off if you quit smoking 15 years ago or 15 in a day. The ACS and NCCN don't have that in their guidelines too. And so I know this is something we've talked about, but you know, as you know, I recently lost my father to lung cancer and he wasn't eligible for lung cancer screening because of that quit year criteria. If he had had access to screening, I do firmly believe he would still be here today. So in addition to that eligibility review of that quit year, there's also push for them to examine biomarkers, of course, as part of their review. So, you know, from my advocacy experience, what's clear is that policymakers and payers too, they want robust evidence demonstrating that these tests can improve outcomes. Value-based care is important. The field needs more clinical utility studies showing that biomarker-based screening leads to early detection, that it leads to screening uptake, allowing for more effective treatments. And I think anyone that knows me, I've said this over and over again, this is not a competition between companies, organizations, or institutions. There are more than enough lives to save. Our work in lung cancer advocacy isn't about individual accolades, company success, institutional triumph. It's about this collective mission to save lives. Every breakthrough, every policy change, every improved screening program, that should be a shared victory that transcends any company, institution, or organizational boundary.
Well said. And I was going to ask you if you had anything else to say before closing. You said quite a bit today and educated me quite a bit. But any other comments at this point?
I think there's, we look towards the future of early lung cancer detection specifically, and I'm encouraged. There's a lot of very sophisticated technology coming out that are looking at different signals, epigenomic, genomic, proteomic, clinical data, defined stage one. I think that second, there's this growing recognition that biomarker tests can complement. Their goal is not to replace LDCT. That is not the goal, but rather to increase more people to get screened. Going back to being a detective, we should be looking at fingerprints, DNA, looking at all different things to find out that early stage patient. And third, we need to move beyond this one size fits all screening recommendations. We need to take a more personalized approach, looking at comprehensive risk assessment. I've been really fortunate to have a swarm of academic colleagues and peers as thought partners that are making so many incredible groundbreaking movements in this area. And I would also say it doesn't matter how great a test is. I want to emphasize the importance of implementation science in this field. Even the best test won't save lives. If it isn't used, we don't have access, it's not covered. It has to be appropriately integrated into the clinical workflow. We need to think about how we communicate results to patients, how we ensure that there's equitable access. And despite there being a lot of challenges in this space and overcoming them, I'm optimistic about the potential for biomarker testing to transform early detection. I think it's going to lead to better follow-up care, more effective treatments for patients, and they could really reduce cancer mortality. So lastly, I'll just say, Dr. Rizzo, I am deeply grateful for your continued leadership in bringing crucial health issues to the forefront, advocating for patients. You're driving meaningful change in this field. You continue to illuminate critical pathways for research, driving grant funding, and patient care. So just as a researcher, a clinician, a scientist, a patient advocate myself, thank you for your unwavering commitment and giving lungs a voice. So I really appreciate you.
Well, thank you very much. And again, thank you for your time today. So to our listeners, if you want to hear more regarding all things respiratory related, we have a great archive of discussions on our show feeds. Be sure again to subscribe and rate Lungcast on your preferred listening or watching platform, and visit lung.org and hcplive.com for more news and resources. Until next time, I'm Dr. Albert Rizzo, reminding you that if you can't breathe, nothing else matters.